Oh, well, I've got another lead. A self-published girlfriend called Catherine Kent. I might visit her later. I won't be able to pick up the phone this afternoon. I'm tailing Miss Brocklehurst. Text me if you need anything. Okay, happy tailing. But it was a dull and fruitless afternoon. Strike was running surveillance on a very well-paid PA, who was believed by her paranoid boss and lover to be sharing not only sexual favours, but also business secrets with a rival. However, Miss Brocklehurst's claim that she wanted to take an afternoon off to be better waxed, manicured and fake tanned for her lover's delectation appeared to be genuine. Strike waited and watched the front of the spa through a rain-speckled window of the Café Nero opposite for nearly 4 hours, earning himself the ire of sundry women with pushchairs, seeking a space to gossip. Finally, Miss Brocklehurst emerged, bisto brown, and presumably almost hairless from the neck down, and after following her for a short distance, Strike saw her slide into a taxi. By a near miracle given the rain, Strike managed to secure a second cab before she had moved out of view, but the sedate pursuit through the clogged, rain-washed streets ended, as he had expected from the direction of travel, at the suspicious boss's own flat. Strike, who had taken photographs covertly all the way, paid his cab fare and mentally clocked off. It was barely 4 o'clock, and the sun was setting, the endless rain becoming chillier. Christmas lights shone from the window of a trattoria as he passed, and his thoughts slipped to Cornwall, which he felt had intruded itself on his notice 3 times in quick succession, calling to him, whispering to him. How long it had been since he had gone home to that beautiful little seaside town, where he had spent the calmest parts of his childhood. 4 years? 5. He met his aunt and uncle whenever they came up to London, as they self-consciously put it, staying at his sister Lucy's house, enjoying the metropolis. Last time, Strike had taken his uncle to the Emirates to watch a match against Manchester City. His phone vibrated in his pocket. Robin, following instructions to the letter as usual, had texted him instead of calling. "Mr. Gunfrey is asking for another meeting tomorrow at his office at 10. Got more to tell you. R. Kiss." "Thanks," Strike texted back. He never added kisses to texts, unless to his sister or aunt. At the Tube, he deliberated his next moves. The whereabouts of Owen Quine felt like an itch in his brain. He was half irritated, half intrigued that the writer was proving so elusive. He pulled the piece of paper that Elizabeth Tassel had given him out of his wallet. Beneath the name Catherine Kent was the address of a tower block in Fulham and a mobile number. Printed along the bottom edge were 2 words, "Indie Author." Strike's knowledge of certain patches of London was as detailed as any cabbie's. While he had never penetrated truly upmarket areas as a child, he had lived in many other addresses around the capital with his late, eternally nomadic mother, usually squats or council accommodation, but occasionally, if her boyfriend of the moment could afford it, in more salubrious surroundings. He recognised Catherine Kent's address. Clement Attlee Court comprised old council blocks, many of which had now been sold off into private hands. Ugly square brick towers with balconies on every floor, they sat within a few hundred yards of million-pound houses in Fulham. There was nobody waiting for him at home, and he was full of coffee and pastries after his long afternoon in Café Nero. Instead of boarding the Northern Line, he took the District Line to West Kensington and set out in the dark along North End Road, past curry houses and a number of small shops with boarded windows folding under the weight of the recession. By the time Strike had reached the tower blocks he sought, night had fallen. Stafford Cripps' house was the block nearest the road, set just behind a low, modern medical centre. The optimistic architect of the council flats, perhaps giddy with socialist idealism, had given each one its own small balcony space. Had they imagined the happy inhabitants tending window boxes and leaning over the railings to call cheery greetings to their neighbours? Virtually all of these exterior areas had been used by the occupants for storage. Old mattresses, prams, kitchen appliances, what looked like armfuls of dirty clothes, sat exposed to the elements, as though cupboards full of junk had been cross-sectioned for public view. a gaggle of hooded youths, smoking beside large plastic recycling bins, eyed him speculatively as he passed. He was taller and broader than any of them.
"Big fucker,"
he caught one of them saying as he passed out of their sight, ignoring the inevitably out-of-order lift and heading for the concrete stairs. Catherine Kent's flat was on the third floor and was reached via a windswept brick balcony that ran the width of the building. Strike noticed that, unlike her neighbours, Catherine had hung real curtains in the windows before rapping on the door. There was no response. If Owen Quine was inside, he was determined not to give himself away. There were no lights on, no sign of movement. An angry-looking woman with a cigarette jammed in her mouth stuck her head out of the next door with almost comical haste, gave Strike one brief searching stare, then withdrew. The chilly wind whistled along the balcony. Strike's overcoat was glistening with raindrops, but his uncovered head, he knew, would look the same as ever. His short, tightly curling hair was impervious to the effects of rain. He drove his hands deep inside his pockets, and there found a stiff envelope he had forgotten. The exterior light beside Catherine Kent's front door was broken, so Strike ambled two doors along to reach a functioning bulb and opened the silver envelope. "Mr. and Mrs. Michael Ellicott request the pleasure of your company at the wedding of their daughter, Robin Venetia, to Mr. Matthew John Cunliffe, at the Church of St. Mary the Virgin, Massam, on Saturday, 8th of January, 2011, at 2 o'clock, and afterwards at Swinton Park." The invitation exuded the authority of military orders. "This wedding will take place in the manner described hereon." He and Charlotte had never got as far as the issuing of stiff cream invitations, engraved with shining black cursive. Strike pushed the card back into his pocket and returned to wait beside Catherine's dark door, digging into himself, staring out over dark Lily Road with its swooshing double lights, headlamps, and reflections sliding along ruby and amber. Down on the ground, the hooded youths huddled, split apart, were joined by others, and regrouped. At 6:30, the expanded gang loped off together in a pack. Strike watched them until they were almost out of sight, at which point they passed a woman coming in the opposite direction. As she moved through the light puddle of a street lamp, he saw a thick mane of bright red hair flying from beneath a black umbrella. Her walk was lopsided, because the hand not holding the umbrella was carrying two heavy carrier bags, but the impression she gave from this distance, regularly tossing back her thick curls, was not unattractive. Her wind-blown hair was eye-catching, and her legs beneath the loose overcoat were slender. Closer and closer she moved, unaware of his scrutiny from three floors up, across the concrete forecourt and out of sight. 5 minutes later, she had emerged onto the balcony where Strike stood waiting. As she drew nearer, the straining buttons on the coat betrayed a heavy, apple-shaped torso. She did not notice Strike until she was 10 yards away, because her head was bowed. But when she looked up, he saw a lined and puffy face, much older than he had expected. Coming to an abrupt halt, she gasped,
"You!"
Strike realized that she was seeing him in silhouette because of the broken lights.
"You fucking bastard!"
The bags hit the concrete floor with a tinkle of breaking glass. She was running full tilt at him, hands balled into fists and flailing.
"You bastard! You bastard! I'll never forgive you, never! You get away from me!"
Strike was forced to parry several wild punches. He stepped backwards as she screeched, throwing ineffectual blows and trying to break past his ex-boxer's defences.
"You wait! Pippa's gonna fucking kill you! You wait!"
The neighbour's door opened again. There stood the same woman with a cigarette in her mouth.
"Oi!"
she said. Light from the hall flooded onto Strike, revealing him. With a half-gasp, half-yelp, the red-headed woman staggered backwards, away from him.
"The fuck's going on?"
demanded the neighbour.
"Case of mistaken identity, I think," said Strike pleasantly.
The neighbour slammed her door, plunging the detective and his assailant back into darkness.
"Who are you?"
she whispered.
What do you want?
Are you Catherine Kent?
What do you want?
Then, with sudden panic, if that's what I think it is, I don't work in that bit. Excuse me?
Who are you, then?
She demanded, sounding more frightened than ever. My name's Cormoran Strike, and I'm a private detective. He was used to the reactions of people who found him unexpectedly on their doorsteps. Catherine's response, stunned silence, was quite typical. She backed away from him and almost fell over her own abandoned carrier bags.
Who set a private detective on me? It's her, is it?
She said ferociously. I've been hired to find the writer Owen Quine, said Strike. He's been missing for nearly a fortnight. I know you're a friend of his.
No, I'm not,
she said, and bent to pick up her bags again. They clinked heavily.
You can tell her that from me. She's welcome to him.
You're not his friend anymore. You don't know where he is.
I don't give a shit where he is.
A cat stalked arrogantly along the edge of the stone balcony.
Can I ask when you last...
No, you can't, she said with an angry gesture.
One of the bags in her hand swung and Strike flinched, thinking that the cat, which had drawn level with her, would be knocked off the ledge into space. It hissed and leapt down. She aimed a swift, spiteful kick at it.
Damn thing, she said.
The cat streaked away.
Move, please. I want to get into my house.
He took a few steps back from the door to let her approach it. She could not find her key. After a few uncomfortable seconds of trying to pat her own pockets while carrying the bags, she was forced to set them down at her feet.
Mr. Quine's been missing since he had a row with his agent about his latest book, said Strike, as Catherine fumbled in her coat. I was wondering whether...
I don't give a shit about his book. I haven't read it, she added.
Her hands were shaking.
Mrs. Kent,
Miss,
she said.
Miss Kent. Mr. Quine's wife says a woman called at his house looking for him. By the description, it sounded...
Catherine Kent had found the key but dropped it. Strike bent to pick it up for her. She snatched it from his grasp.
I don't know what you're talking about.
You didn't go looking for him at his house last week.
I told you, I don't know where he is. I don't know anything.
She snapped, ramming the key into the lock and turning it. She caught up the two bags, one of which clinked heavily again. It was, Strike saw, from a local hardware store.
That looks heavy.
My ballcock's gone,
she told him fiercely. And she slammed her door in his face. Chapter 10 Verdun. We came to fight. Clermont.
Ye shall fight, gentlemen, and fight enough, but a short turn or two.
Francis Beaumont and Philip Massinger, the little French lawyer. Robin emerged from the tube the following morning, clutching a redundant umbrella and feeling sweaty and uncomfortable. After days of downpours, the tube train full of the smell of wet cloth, of slippery pavements and rain-speckled windows, the sudden switch to bright, dry weather had taken her by surprise. Other spirits might have lightened in the respite from the deluge and lowering grey clouds, but not Robin's. She and Matthew had had a bad row. It was almost a relief when she opened the glass door engraved with Strike's name and job title to find that her boss was already on the telephone in his own office, with the door closed. She felt obscurely that she needed to pull herself together before she faced him, because Strike had been the subject of last night's argument.
"You've invited him to the wedding,"
Matthew had said sharply. She had been afraid that Strike might mention the invitation over drinks that evening, and that if she did not warn Matthew first, Strike would bear the brunt of Matthew's displeasure.
"Since when are we just asking people without telling each other?"
Matthew had said.
"I meant to tell you. I thought I had."
Then Robin had felt angry with herself. She never lied to Matthew.
"He's my boss. He'll expect to be invited."
Which wasn't true. She doubted that Strike cared one way or the other.
"Well, I'd like him there," she said,
which at last was honesty. She wanted to tug the working life that she had never enjoyed so much closer to the personal life that currently refused to meld with it. She wanted to stitch the two together in a satisfying whole,
and to see Strike in the congregation, approving. Approving. Why did he have to approve of her marrying Matthew? She had known that Matthew would not be happy, but she had hoped that by this time the two men would have met and liked each other, and it was not her fault that that had not happened yet. "After all the bloody fuss we had when I wanted to invite Sarah Shadlock," Matthew had said, a blow, Robin felt, that was below the belt. "Invite her, then," she said angrily. "But it's hardly the same thing. Cormoran's never tried to get me into bed. What's that snort supposed to mean?" The argument had been in full swing when Matthew's father telephoned with the news that a funny turn Matthew's mother had suffered the previous week had been diagnosed as a mini-stroke. After this, she and Matthew felt that squabbling about Strike was in bad taste, so they went to bed in an unsatisfactory state of theoretical reconciliation, both, Robin knew, still seething. It was nearly midday before Strike finally emerged from his office. He was not wearing his suit today, but a dirty and holy sweater, jeans and trainers. His face was thick with the heavy stubble that accrued if he did not shave every 24 hours. Forgetting her own troubles, Robin stared. She had never, even in the days when he was sleeping in the office, known Strike to look like a down-and-out. "Been making calls for the Ingalls file and getting some numbers for Longman," Strike told Robin, handing her the old-fashioned brown card folders, each with a handwritten serial number on the spine that he had used in the Special Investigation Branch and which remained his favourite way of collating information. "Is that a deliberate look?" she asked, staring at what looked like grease marks on the knees of his jeans. "Yeah, it's for Gumphrey. Long story." While Strike made them both tea, they discussed details of three current cases, Strike updating Robin on information received and further points to be investigated. "And what about Owen Quine?" Robin asked, accepting her mug. "What did his agent say?" Strike lowered himself onto the sofa, which made its usual farting noises beneath him, and filled her in on the details of his interview with Elizabeth Tassel and his visit to Catherine Kent. "When she first saw me, I could swear she thought I was Quine." Robin laughed. "You're not that fat." "Cheers, Robin," he said dryly. "When she realized I wasn't Quine, and before she knew who I was, she said, 'I don't work in that bit.' Does that mean anything to you?"
"No, but," she added diffidently, "I did manage to find out a bit about Catherine Kent yesterday."
"How?" asked Strike, taken aback.
"Well, you told me she's a self-published writer," Robin reminded him. "So I thought I'd look online and see what's out there, and—"
With two clicks of her mouse, she brought up the page.
"She's got a blog."
"Good going," said Strike, moving gladly off the sofa and round the desk to read over Robin's shoulder. The amateurish webpage was called My Literary Life, decorated with drawings of quills and a very flattering picture of Catherine that Strike thought must be a good 10 years out of date. The blog comprised a list of posts arranged by date like a diary. "A lot of it's about how traditional publishers wouldn't know good books if they were hit over the head with them," said Robin, scrolling slowly down the webpage so he could look at it. "She's written 3 novels in what she calls an erotic fantasy series called The Melina Saga. They're available for download on Kindle."
"I don't want to read any more bad books. I had enough with the brother's balls ache," said Strike. "Anything about Quine?"
"Loads," said Robin, "assuming he's the man she calls the famous writer, TFW for short."
"I doubt she's sleeping with 2 authors, said Strike. "It must be him. Famous is stretching it a bit, though. Had you heard of Quine before Leonora walked in?"
"No," admitted Robin. "Here he is, look, on the 2nd of November."
Great talk with TFW about plot and narrative tonight, which are, of course, not the same thing. For those wondering, plot is what happens, narrative is how much you show your readers, and how you show it to them. An example from my second novel, Melina's Sacrifice. As they made their way towards the forest of Harderel,
Lendor raised his handsome profile to see how near they were to it. His well-maintained body, honed by horseback riding and archery skills.
"Scroll up," said Strike. "See what else there is about Quine."
Robin obliged, pausing on a post from the 21st of October. "So TFW calls and he can't see me, again. Family problems. What can I do except say that I understand? I knew it would be complicated when we fell in love. I can't be openly explicit on this, but I'll just say he's stuck with a wife he doesn't love because of a third party. Not his fault, not the third party's fault. The wife won't let him go, even if it's the best thing for everyone, so we're locked into what sometimes feels like it's purgatory. The wife knows about me and pretends not to. I don't know how she can stand living with a man who wants to be with someone else, because I know I couldn't do it. TFW says she's always put the third party before everything else, including him. Strange how often being a carer masks deep selfishness. Some people will say it's all my fault for falling in love with a married man. You're not telling me anything, my friends, my sister and my own mother don't tell me all the time. I've tried to call it off, and what can I say, except the heart has its reasons, which reasons don't know. And now, tonight I'm crying over him all over again for a brand new reason. He tells me he's nearly finished his masterpiece. The book, he says, is the best he's ever written. I hope you'll like it. You're in it. What do you say when a famous writer writes you into what he says is his best book? I understand what he's giving me in ways a non-writer can't. It makes you feel proud and humble. Yes, there are people we writers let into our hearts, but into our books. That's special. That's different. Can't help loving TFW. The heart has its reasons. There was an exchange of comments below. What would you say if I told you he'd read a bit to me? Pippa, 2011. You better be joking, Pip. He won't read me any. Kath. You wait, Pippa, 2011. Kiss, 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 kiss. Interesting, said Strike. Very interesting. When Kent attacked me last night, she assured me that someone called Pippa wanted to kill me. Look at this, then, said Robin in excitement, scrolling down to November the 9th. The first time I ever met TFW, he said to me, "You're not writing properly unless someone is bleeding. Probably you." As followers of this blog know, I've metaphorically opened my veins both here and also in my novels. But today, I feel like I have been fatally stabbed by somebody who I had learned to trust. Oh, Macheath, thou hast robbed me of my quiet. To see thee tortured would give me pleasure. Where's that quotation from? Asked Strike. Robin's nimble fingers danced across the keyboard. The Beggar's Opera by John Gay. Erudite for a woman who confuses Y-O-U apostrophe R-E and Y-O-U-R and goes in for random capitalization. We can't all be literary geniuses, said Robin reproachfully. Thank Christ for that, from all I'm hearing about him. But look at the comment under the quotation, said Robin, returning to Catherine's blog. She clicked on the link, and a single sentence was revealed. I'll turn the handle on the fucking rack for you, Kath. This comment, too, had been made by Pippa, 2011. Pippa sounds a handful, doesn't she? Commented Strike. Anything about what Kent does for a living on here? I'm assuming she's not paying the bills with her erotic fantasies. That's a bit odd, too. Look at this bit. On the 28th of October, Catherine had written, Like most writers, I also have a day job. I can't say too much about it for security reasons. This week, security has been tightened at our facility again, which means in consequence that my officious co-worker, born-again Christian, sanctimonious on the subject of my private life, has an excuse to suggest to management that blogs, etc., should be viewed in case sensitive information is revealed. Fortunately, it seems sense has prevailed, and no action is being taken. Mysterious, said Strike.
Titan Security, Women's Prison, Psychiatric Hospital? Or are we talking industrial secrets?
And look at this, on the 13th of November. Robin scrolled right down to the most recent post on the blog, which was the only entry after that in which Catherine claimed to have been fatally stabbed. My beloved sister has lost her long battle with breast cancer 3 days ago. Thank you all for your good wishes and support. Two comments had been added below this, which Robin opened. Pippa 2011 had written, "So sorry to hear this, Kath. Sending you all the love in the world. Kiss, kiss, kiss." Catherine had replied, "Thanks, Pippa. You're a real friend. Kiss, 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 kiss." Catherine's advance thanks for multiple messages of support sat very sadly above the short exchange.
"Why?" asked Strike heavily.
"Why what?" said Robin, looking up at him.
"Why do people do this?"
"Blog, you mean? I don't know. Didn't someone once say the unexamined life isn't worth living?"
"Yeah, Plato," said Strike. "But this isn't examining a life, it's exhibiting it."
"Oh, God," said Robin, slopping tea down herself as she gave a guilty start. "I forgot, there's something else. Christian Fisher called just as I was walking out the door last night. He wants to know if you're interested in writing a book."
"He what?"
"A book," said Robin, fighting the urge to laugh at the expression of disgust on Strike's face. "About your life. Your experiences in the army and solving the Lula Landry. Call him back," Strike said, "and tell him no, I'm not interested in writing a book." He drained his mug and headed for the peg where an ancient leather jacket now hung beside his black overcoat. "You haven't forgotten tonight," Robin said, with a knot that had temporarily dissolved tight in her stomach again.
"Tonight?"
"Drinks," she said desperately. "Me, Matthew, the King's Arms."
"No, I haven't forgotten," he said, wondering why she looked so tense and miserable. "Spect I'll be out all afternoon, so I'll see you there. 8, was it?"
6:30, said Robin, tenser than ever.
6:30. Right. I'll be there. Venetia? She did a double take.
"How did you know?"
"It's on the invitation," said Strike. "Unusual. Where did that come from?"
I was conceived there, apparently," she said, pink in the face. "In Venice." "What's your middle name?" she asked over his laughter, half amused, half cross. "C.B. Strike. What's the B?"
"Gotta get going," said Strike. "See you at 8.
6:30!
She bellowed at the closing door.
Strike's destination that afternoon was a shop that sold electronic accessories in Crouch End. Stolen mobile phones and laptops were unlocked in a back room, the personal information therein extracted, and the purged devices and the information were then sold separately to those who could use them. The owner of this thriving business was causing Mr. Gumfrey, Strike's client, considerable inconvenience. Mr. Gumfrey, who was every bit as crooked as the man whom Strike had tracked to his business headquarters, but on a larger and more flamboyant scale, had made a mistake in treading on the wrong toes. It was Strike's view that Gumfrey needed to clear out while he was ahead. He knew of what this adversary was capable. They had an acquaintance in common. The target greeted Strike in an upstairs office that smelled as bad as Elizabeth Tassel's, while two shell-suited youths lolled around in the background picking their nails. Strike, who was impersonating a thug for hire, recommended by their mutual acquaintance, listened as his would-be employer confided that he was intending to target Mr. Gumfrey's teenage son, about whose movements he was frighteningly well informed. He went so far as to offer Strike the job. £500 to cut the boy.
"I don't want no murder. Just a message to his father, you get me?"
It was gone 6 before Strike managed to extricate himself from the premises. His first call, once he had made sure he had not been followed, was to Mr. Gumfrey himself, whose appalled silence told Strike that he had at last realized what he was up against. Strike then phoned Robin.
Gonna be late, sorry, he said.
Where are you? She asked, sounding strained. He could hear the sounds of the pub behind her, conversation and laughter.
Crouch End.
Oh, God, he heard her say under her breath. It'll take you ages.
I'll get a cab, he assured her. Be as quick as I can.
Why, Strike wondered, as he sat in the taxi rumbling along Upper Street, had Matthew chosen a pub in Waterloo? To make sure that Strike had to travel a long way? Payback for Strike having chosen pubs convenient to him on their previous attempts to meet. Strike hoped the King's Arms served food. He was suddenly very hungry. It took 40 minutes to reach his destination, partly because the row of 19th-century workers' cottages where the pub stood was blocked to traffic. Strike chose to get out and end the curmudgeonly taxi driver's attempt to make sense of the street numbering, which appeared not to follow a logical sequence, and proceeded on foot, wondering whether the difficulty of finding the place had influenced Matthew's choice. The King's Arms turned out to be a picturesque Victorian corner pub, the entrances of which were surrounded by a mixture of professional young men in suits and what looked like students, all smoking and drinking. The small crowd parted easily as he approached, giving him a wider berth than was strictly necessary, even for a man of his height and breadth. As he crossed the threshold into the small bar, Strike wondered, not without a faint hope that it might happen, whether he might be asked to leave on account of his filthy clothes. Meanwhile, in the noisy back room, which was a glass-ceilinged courtyard, self-consciously crammed with bric-a-brac, Matthew was looking at his watch. "It's nearly a quarter past," he told Robin. Clean-cut in his suit and tie, he was, as usual, the handsomest man in the room. Robin was used to seeing women's eyes swivel as he walked past them. She had never quite managed to make up her mind how aware Matthew was of their swift, burning glances. Sitting at the long wooden bench that they had been forced to share with a party of cackling students, 6'1", with a firm cleft chin and bright blue eyes, he looked like a thoroughbred kept in a paddock of Highland ponies.
"That's him," said Robin, with a surge of relief and apprehension.
Strike seemed to have become larger and rougher looking since he had left the office. He moved easily towards them through the packed room, his eyes on Robin's bright gold head, one large hand grasping a pint of hophead. Matthew stood up. It looked as though he braced himself.
"Cormoran, hi! You found it."
"You're Matthew," said Strike, holding out a hand.
"Sorry I'm so late. I tried to get away earlier, but I was with the sort of bloke you wouldn't want to turn your back on without permission."
Matthew returned an empty smile. He had expected Strike to be full of those kinds of comments, self-dramatizing, trying to make a mystery of what he did. By the look of him, he'd been changing attire.
"Sit down," Robin told Strike nervously, moving along the bench so far that she was almost falling off the end. "Are you hungry? We were just talking about ordering something."
"They do reasonably decent food," said Matthew. "Thai. It's not the mango tree, but it's all right."
Strike smiled without warmth. He had expected Matthew to be like this, name-dropping restaurants in Belgravia to prove, after a single year in London, that he was a seasoned metropolitan.
"How did it go this afternoon?" Robin asked Strike.
She thought that if Matthew only heard about the sort of things that Strike did, he would become as fascinated as she was by the process of detection, and his every prejudice would fall away. But Strike's brief description of his afternoon, omitting all identifying detail of those involved, met barely concealed indifference on the part of Matthew. Strike then offered them both a drink, as they were holding empty glasses.
"You could show a bit of interest,"
Robin hissed at Matthew once Strike was out of earshot at the bar.
"Robin, he met a man in a shop," said Matthew. "I doubt they'll be optioning the film rights any time soon."
Pleased with his own wit, he turned his attention to the blackboard menu on the opposite wall. When Strike had returned with drinks, Robin insisted on battling her way up to the bar with their food order. She dreaded leaving the two men alone together, but felt that they might, somehow, find their own level without her.
Matthew's brief increase in self-satisfaction ebbed away in Robin's absence.
"Your ex-army," he found himself telling Strike, even though he'd been determined not to permit Strike's life experience to dominate the conversation.
"That's right," said Strike. "SOB."
Matthew was not sure what that was.
"My father's ex-RAF," he said. "Yeah, he was in same time as Jeff Young."
"Who?"
"Welsh rugby union player. 23 caps," said Matthew.
"Right," said Strike.
"Yeah, Dad made squadron leader. Left at 86 and he's run his own property management business since. Done all right for himself."
"Nothing like your old man," said Matthew, a little defensively. "But all right."
"Tit," thought Strike.
"What are you talking about?" Robin said anxiously, sitting back down.
"Just Dad," said Matthew.
"Poor thing," said Robin.
"Why poor thing?" snapped Matthew.
"Well, he's worried about your mum, isn't he? The mini stroke."
"Oh," said Matthew, "that."
Strike had met men like Matthew in the army, always officer class, but with that little pocket of insecurity just beneath the smooth surface that made them overcompensate and sometimes overreach.
"So, how are things at Lao the French?"
Robin asked Matthew, willing him to show Strike what a nice man he was, to show the real Matthew, whom she loved.
"Matthew's auditing this really odd little publishing company. They're quite funny, aren't they?" she said to her fiancé.
"I wouldn't call it funny, the shambles they're in," said Matthew.
And he talked until their food arrived, littering his chat with references to 90K and a quarter of a mil, and every sentence was angled like a mirror to show him in the best possible light. His cleverness, his quick thinking, his besting of slower, stupider, yet more senior colleagues. His patronage of the dullards working for the firm he was auditing.
"Trying to justify a Christmas party when they've barely broken even in 2 years. It'll be more like a wake."
Matthew's confident strictures on the small firm were followed by the arrival of their food and silence. Robin, who had been hoping that Matthew would reproduce for Strike some of the kinder, more affectionate things he had found to tell her about the eccentrics at the small press, could think of nothing to say. However, Matthew's mention of a publishing party had just given Strike an idea. The detective's jaws worked more slowly. It had occurred to him that there might be an excellent opportunity to seek information on Owen Quine's whereabouts, and his capacious memory volunteered a small piece of information he had forgotten he knew.
"Got a girlfriend, Cormoran?"
Matthew asked Strike directly.
It was something he was keen to establish. Robin had been vague on the point.
"No," said Strike absently.
"Excuse me, won't be long. Gotta make a phone call."
"Yeah, no problem,"
said Matthew irritably, but only once Strike was once again out of earshot.
"You're 40 minutes late and then you piss off during dinner. We'll just sit here waiting till you deign to come back."
"Matt!"
Reaching the dark pavement, Strike pulled out cigarettes and his mobile phone. Lighting up, he walked away from his fellow smokers to the quiet end of the side street, to stand in darkness beneath the brick arches that bore the railway line. Culpepper answered on the third ring.
"Strike," he said. "How's it going?"
"Good. Calling to ask a favour."
"Go on,"
said Culpepper, non-committally.
"You've got a cousin called Nina who works for Roper Chard."
"How the hell do you know that?"
"You told me," said Strike, patiently.
"When?"
"A few months ago when I was investigating that dodgy dentist for you."
"Your fucking memory," said Culpepper, sounding less impressed than unnerved. "It's not normal. What about her?"
"Couldn't put me in touch with her, could you?" asked Strike. "Roper Chard have got an anniversary party tomorrow night and I'd like to go."
"Why?"
"I've got a case," said Strike evasively.
He never shared with Culpepper details of the high society divorces and business ruptures he was investigating, in spite of Culpepper's frequent requests to do so.
"And I just gave you the scoop of your bloody career."
"Yeah, all right,"
said the journalist grudgingly, after a short hesitation.
"I suppose I could do that for you."
"Is she single?" Strike asked.
"What, you're after a shag too?" said Culpepper.
And Strike noted that he seemed amused instead of peeved at the thought of Strike trying it on with his cousin.
No, I want to know whether it'll look suspicious if she takes me to the party.
Oh, right. I think she's just split up with someone. I don't know. I'll text you the number.
Wait till Sunday, Culpepper added with barely suppressed glee. A tsunami of shit's about to hit Lord Porker.
Call Nina for me first, will you? Strike asked him. And tell her who I am so she understands the gig.
Culpepper agreed to it and rang off. In no particular hurry to return to Matthew, Strike smoked his cigarette down to the butt before moving back inside. The packed room, he thought, as he made his way across it, bowing his head to avoid hanging pots and street signs, was like Matthew. It tried too hard. The decor included an old-fashioned stove and an ancient till, multiple shopping baskets, old prints and plates, a contrived panoply of junk shop finds. Matthew had hoped to have finished his noodles before Strike returned, to underline the length of his absence, but had not quite managed it. Robin was looking miserable, and Strike, wondering what had passed between them while he had been gone, felt sorry for her.
"Robin says you're a rugby player," he told Matthew, determined to make an effort. "Could have played county, is that right?"
They made laborious conversation for another hour. The wheels turned most easily while Matthew was able to talk about himself. Strike noticed Robin's habit of feeding Matthew lines and cues, each designed to open up an area of conversation in which he could shine.
"How long have you two been together?" he asked.
9 years, said Matthew, with a slight return of his former combative air.
"That long?" said Strike, surprised. "What, were you at university together?"
"School," said Robin, smiling. "Sixth form."
"Wasn't a big school," said Matthew. "She was the only girl with any brains that was fanciable. No choice."
"Tosser," thought Strike.
Their way home lay together as far as Waterloo Station. They walked through the darkness, continuing to make small talk, then parted at the entrance to the tube. "There," said Robin hopelessly, as she and Matthew walked away towards the escalator.
"He's nice, isn't he?"
"Punctuality's shit," said Matthew, who could find no other charge to lay against Strike that did not sound insane. "He'll probably arrive 40 minutes bloody late and ruin the service." But it was tacit consent to Strike's attendance, and, in the absence of genuine enthusiasm, Robin supposed it could have been worse. Matthew, meanwhile, was brooding in silence on things he would have confessed to nobody. Robin had accurately described her boss's looks, the pube-like hair, the boxer's profile. But Matthew had not expected Strike to be so big. He had a couple of inches on Matthew, who enjoyed being the tallest man in his office. What was more, while he would have found it distasteful showboating if Strike had held forth about his experiences in Afghanistan and Iraq, or told them how his leg had been blown off, or how he had earned the medal that Robin seemed to find so impressive, his silence on these subjects had been almost more irritating. Strike's heroism, his action-packed life, his experiences of travel and danger had somehow hovered, spectrally, over the conversation. Beside him on the train, Robin, too, sat in silence. She had not enjoyed the evening one bit. Never before had she known Matthew quite like that, or at least, never before had she seen him like that. It was Strike, she thought, puzzling over the matter as the train jolted them. Strike had somehow made her see Matthew through his eyes. She did not know quite how he had done it, all that questioning Matthew about rugby. Some people might have thought it was polite, but Robin knew better. Or was she just annoyed that he had been late, and blaming him for things that he had not intended? And so the engaged couple sped home, united in unexpressed irritation with the man now snoring loudly as he rattled away from them on the Northern Line. Chapter 11. Let me know wherefore I should be thus neglected. John Webster, The Duchess of Malfi.
"Is that Cormoran Strike?"
asked a girlish, upper-middle-class voice at 8:40 the following morning.
"It is," said Strike.
"It's Nina Lascelles.
Dominic gave me your number.
Oh, yeah, said Strike, who was standing bare-chested in front of the shaving mirror he usually kept beside the kitchen sink, the shower room being both dark and cramped. Wiping shaving foam from around his mouth with his forearm, he said,
Did he tell you what it was about, Nina?
Yeah, you want to infiltrate Roper Chard's anniversary party.
Infiltrate is a bit strong.
But it sounds much more exciting if we say infiltrate.
Fair enough, he said, amused. I take it you're up for this.
Oh, yes, fun. Am I allowed to guess why you want to come and spy on everyone?
Again, spy isn't really.
Stop spoiling things. Am I allowed to guess?
Go on, then, said Strike, taking a sip from his mug of tea, his eyes on the window. It was foggy again, the brief spell of sunshine extinguished.
Bombyx Mori, said Nina. Am I right? I am, aren't I? Say I'm right.
You're right, said Strike, and she gave a squeal of pleasure.
I'm not even supposed to be talking about it. There's been a lockdown, emails round the company, lawyers storming in and out of Daniel's office. Where shall we meet? We should hook up somewhere first and turn up together, don't you think?
Yeah, definitely, said Strike. Where's good for you?
Even as he took a pen from the coat hanging behind the door, he thought longingly of an evening at home, a good long sleep, an interlude of peace and rest before an early start on Saturday morning, tailing his brunette client's faithless husband. Do you know ye old Cheshire Cheese? Asked Nina. On Fleet Street. Nobody from work will be in there, and it's walking distance to the office. I know it's corny, but I love it. They agreed to meet at 7:30. As Strike returned to his shaving, he asked himself how likely it was that he would meet anyone who knew Quine's whereabouts at his publisher's party. The trouble is, Strike mentally chided the reflection in the circular mirror as the pair of them strafed stubble from their chins.
You keep acting like you're still SIB.
The nation's not paying you to be thorough any more, mate. But he knew no other way. It was part of a short but inflexible personal code of ethics that he had carried with him all his adult life. Do the job, and do it well. Strike was intending to spend most of the day in the office, which under normal circumstances he enjoyed. He and Robin shared the paperwork. She was an intelligent and often helpful sounding board, and as fascinated now with the mechanics of an investigation as she had been when she had joined him. Today, however, he headed downstairs with something bordering on reluctance, and, sure enough, his seasoned antennae detected in her greeting a self-conscious edge that he feared would shortly break through into, "What did you think of Matthew?" This, Strike reflected, retiring to the inner office and shutting the door on the pretext of making phone calls, was exactly why it was a bad idea to meet your only member of staff outside working hours. Hunger forced him to emerge a few hours later. Robin had bought sandwiches as usual, but she had not knocked on the door to let him know that they were there. This, too, seemed to point to feelings of awkwardness after the previous evening. To postpone the moment when it must be mentioned, and in the hope that if he kept off the subject long enough, she might never bring it up, although he had never known the tactic to work on a woman before, Strike told her truthfully that he had just got off the phone with Mr. Gumfrey. "Is he going to go to the police?" asked Robin.
No. Gumfrey isn't the type of bloke who goes to the police if someone's bothering him. He's nearly as bent as the bloke who wants to cut his son. He's realised he's in over his head this time, though.
"Didn't you think of recording what that gangster was paying you to do and taking it to the police yourself?" asked Robin, without thinking.
"No, Robin, because it'd be obvious where the tip-off came from, and it'll put a strain on business if I got to dodge hired killers while doing surveillance."
"But Gumfrey can't keep his son at home forever."
"He won't have to. He's going to take the family off for a surprise holiday in the States, phone our knife-happy friend from L.A., and tell him he's given the matter some thought and changed his mind about interfering with his business interests. Shouldn't look too suspicious. The bloke's already done enough shitty stuff to him to warrant a cooling off. Bricks through his windscreen, threatening calls to his wife. Suppose I'll have to go back to Crouch End next week. Say the boy never showed up, and give his monkey back. Strike sighed. Not very plausible, but I don't want them to come looking for me.
He gave you a...
monkey. 500 quid, Robin, said Strike. What do they call that in Yorkshire?
Shockingly little to stab a teenager, said Robin forcefully, and then, catching Strike off guard, what did you think of Matthew?
Nice bloke, lied Strike automatically. He refrained from elaboration. She was no fool. He had been impressed before now by her instinct for the lie, the false note. Nevertheless, he could not help hurrying them on to a different subject.
I'm starting to think maybe next year, if we're turning a proper profit, and you've already had your pay rise, we could justify taking someone else on. I'm working flat out here. I can't keep going like this forever. How many clients have you turned down lately?
A couple, Robin responded coolly.
Surmising that he had been insufficiently enthusiastic about Matthew, but resolute that he would not be any more hypocritical than he had already been, Strike withdrew shortly afterwards into his office and shut the door again. However, on this occasion, Strike was only half right. Robin had indeed felt deflated by his response. She knew that if Strike had genuinely liked Matthew, he would never have been as definitive as "nice bloke." He'd have said, "Yeah, he's all right," or "I suppose you could do worse." What had irritated, and even hurt, was his suggestion of bringing in another employee. Robin turned back to her computer monitor and started typing fast and furiously, banging the keys harder than usual as she made up this week's invoice for the divorcing brunette. She had thought, evidently wrongly, that she was here as more than a secretary. She had helped Strike secure the evidence that had convicted Lula Landry's killer. She had even collected some of it alone, on her own initiative. In the months since, she had several times operated way beyond the duties of a PA, accompanying Strike on surveillance jobs when it would look more natural for him to be in a couple, charming doormen and recalcitrant witnesses who instinctively took offence at Strike's bulk and surly expression, not to mention pretending to be a variety of women on the telephone that Strike, with his deep bass voice, had no hope of impersonating. Robin had assumed that Strike was thinking along the same lines that she was. He occasionally said things like, "It's good for your detective training," or, "You could use a counter-surveillance course." She had assumed that once the business was on a sounder footing, and she could plausibly claim to have helped make it so, she would be given the training she knew she needed. But now it seemed that these hints had been mere throwaway lines, vague pats on the head for the typist. So what was she doing here? Why had she thrown away something much better? In her temper, Robin chose to forget how little she had wanted that human resources job, however well paid. Perhaps the new employee would be female, able to perform these useful jobs, and she, Robin, would become receptionist and secretary to both of them, and never leave her desk again. It was not for that she had stayed with Strike, given up a much better salary, and created a recurring source of tension in her relationship. At 5 o'clock on the dot, Robin stopped typing in mid-sentence, pulled on her trench coat and left, closing the glass door behind her with unnecessary force. The bang woke Strike up. He had been fast asleep at his desk, his head on his arms. Checking his watch, he saw that it was 5 and wondered who had just come into the office. Only when he opened the dividing door and saw that Robin's coat and bag were gone and her computer monitor dark, did he realize that she had left without saying goodbye. "Oh, for fuck's sake," he said impatiently. She wasn't usually sulky. It was one of the many things he liked about her. What did it matter if he didn't like Matthew? He wasn't the one marrying him. Muttering irritably under his breath, Strike locked up and climbed the stairs to his attic room, intending to eat and change before meeting Nina Lascelles. Chapter 12. She is a woman of an excellent assurance and an extraordinary happy wit and tongue.
Ben Jonson, Epicene, or The Silent Woman. Strike proceeded along the dark, cold Strand towards Fleet Street that evening, with his hands balled deep in his pockets, walking as briskly as fatigue and an increasingly sore right leg would permit. He regretted leaving the peace and comfort of his glorified bedsit. He was not sure that anything useful would come of this evening's expedition, and yet, almost against his will, he was struck anew in the frosty haze of this winter's night by the aged beauty of the old city to which he owed a divided childhood allegiance. Every taint of the touristic was wiped away by the freezing November evening. The 17th-century façade of the Old Bell Tavern, with its diamond window panes aglow, exuded a noble antiquity. The dragon standing sentinel on top of the Temple Bar marker was silhouetted, stark and fierce, against the star-studded blackness above. And in the far distance, the misty dome of St. Paul's shone like a rising moon. High on a brick wall above him, as he approached his destination, were names that spoke of Fleet Street's inky past. The People's Friend, the Dundee Courier. But Culpepper and his journalistic ilk had long since been driven out of their traditional home to Wapping and Canary Wharf. The law dominated the area now. The Royal Courts of Justice staring down upon the passing detective, the ultimate temple of Strike's trade. In this forgiving and strangely sentimental mood, Strike approached the round yellow lamp across the road that marked the entrance to Ye Olde Cheshire Cheese and headed up the narrow passageway that led to the entrance, stooping to avoid hitting his head on the low lintel. A cramped wood-panelled entrance lined with ancient oil paintings opened onto a tiny front room. Strike ducked again, avoiding the faded wooden sign, "Gentlemen only in this bar," and was greeted at once with an enthusiastic wave from a pale petite girl whose dominant feature was a pair of large brown eyes. Huddled in a black coat beside the log fire, she was cradling an empty glass in two small white hands.
"Nina?"
"I knew it was you. Dominic described you to a T."
"Can I get you a drink?"
She asked for a white wine. Strike fetched himself a pint of Sam Smith and edged onto the uncomfortable wooden bench beside her. London accents filled the room. As though she had read his mood, Nina said, "It's still a real pub. It's only people who never come here who think it's full of tourists. And Dickens came here, and Johnson and Yeats. I love it." She beamed at him, and he smiled back, mustering real warmth with several mouthfuls of beer inside him.
"How far is your office?"
"About a 10-minute walk," she said. "We're just off the Strand. It's a new building and there's a roof garden. It's going to be bloody freezing," she added, giving a preemptive shiver and drawing her coat more tightly around her. "But the bosses had an excuse not to hire anywhere. Times are hard in publishing."
"There's been some trouble about Bombix Morrie, you said?" asked Strike, getting down to business as he stretched out his prosthetic leg as far as it would go under the table.
"Trouble," she said, "is the understatement of the century. Daniel Chard's livid. You don't make Daniel Chard the baddie in a dirty novel. Not done. No, bad idea. He's a strange man. They say he got sucked into the family business, but he really wanted to be an artist. Like Hitler," she added with a giggle. The lights over the bar danced in her big eyes. She looked, Strike thought, like an alert and excited mouse.
"Hitler," he repeated, faintly amused.
"He rants like Hitler when he's upset. We found that out this week. Nobody's ever heard Daniel speak above a mumble before this. Shouting and screaming at Jerry, we could hear him through the walls."
"Have you read the book?"
She hesitated, a naughty grin playing around her mouth. "Not officially," she said at last.
"But unofficially?"
"I might have had a sneaky peek," she said.
"Isn't it under lock and key?"
"Well, yeah, it's in Jerry's safe." A sly sideways glance invited Strike to join her in gentle mockery of the innocent editor.
The trouble is, he's told everyone the combination because he keeps forgetting it, and that means he can ask us to remind him. Jerry's the sweetest, straightest man in the world, and I don't think it would have occurred to him that